From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Sunset.
Outer Sunset.
North Beach.
Mill Valley.
Knob Hill.
Berkeley, California.
Berkeley.
Albany.
Alameda.
The Presidio.
Coming up, we'll hear how the delayed crab season is affecting local fishermen.
Pretty scary. I've never been without income this time of year because it's been like 5 months since we did anything.
When will it be safe to crab again? Then,
people are always sending me pictures of white sharks.
Does that mean there are more great whites in our part of the Pacific?
Not sure yet, but it certainly means that there are more white sharks being photographed.
And we'll dive into literature to hear about two Welsh girls who turn from enemies to allies when the English come colonizing.
So I'm fascinated by stories about cultures that are in collision.
Crabs, sharks, and whales. Today on Cross Currents. California's Dungeness crab season usually opens on November 15th, but this year it's been put on hold indefinitely. The Department of Public Health found high levels of toxins in the crab. Last week, lawmakers, scientists, and crabbers met in Santa Rosa to talk about the financial and public health impacts of the delay. Charlton Bonham, the director of California Fish and Wildlife, had this to say to the room full of fishermen.
The first thing I want to say to you is I'm sorry. I know this is hurting you.
The delay of this $60 million industry has put a big financial strain on local fishermen. It also has some climate scientists worried that it could be a sign of more problems to come. KALW's Angela Johnston reports.
If you walk along the Pillar Point Harbor in Half Moon Bay on a typical winter weekend, it would be buzzing with activity. Jake Bunch knows what it usually sounds like.
You'd hear a lot of boat engines. That's the main thing. Coming and going or staying tied up and pumping water on their crab. You can almost hear it from, like, the next town over.
Bunch is one of the harbor's dozens of crab fishermen. He points out the cranes that fishermen use to load gear onto boats.
What does that sound like?
It's kind of like, it's just motors running.
But right now, it's different. Quiet. That's because scientists found an unsafe level of a toxin in the local crabs this year. It's there because of a big concentration of algae along the west coast, called an algal bloom. Because of the toxin, the commercial crabbing season is on hold indefinitely. Jake Bunch got into crabbing 3 years ago and spent a lot of money on a permit. He didn't want to share how much, but a permit can run you up to $200,000.
When you jump into this career, it becomes everything for you. It's really, really hard to, like, let the boat sit here and go do something else.
Don Pemberton has been fishing crabs since 1976.
We're hooking up our baiter.
What does that do?
Chops up squid, sardines, mackerel.
He's passing the time doing some repairs on his boat, the Stacy Joanne. But he's worried.
Pretty scary. I've never been without income this time of year because it's been like 5 months since we did anything.
Some fishermen have left their boats behind to look for temporary work, like construction or odd jobs. Others bought permits to fish different species, like rock cod. Jimmy Anderson is working on side projects to help out the fishery.
You have a fleet of boats out that are picking up lost and derelict pots and bringing those in.
Anderson's been fishing crab out here since he was in high school. Back then,
there was like 100 boats that would fish in that area. And last year there was 430, so it's quite a boom.
Wow. So 430 people that aren't really doing anything right now.
Well, yes, true.
Anderson says he's hoping the Department of Public Health and the Department of Fish and Wildlife will reopen the fishery before the Christmas season, when crabbers make a lot of their income. Four Congress members have actually called on Governor Brown to create a relief fund for fishermen if the season gets canceled entirely. But even if it doesn't, Anderson's worried about what could happen next year.
I've heard scientists on both ends of that. You know, this is the new normal and this is going to be forever. But then I've heard scientists that say, well, like in 91, you had it in the past for a period of time and then it went away and the crabs were fine and everybody just got on with life. So I don't know. I don't try to guess the future in those respects.
Clarissa Anderson, no relation to Jimmy, is a biological oceanographer with UC Santa Cruz. She says it's normal for toxic algae to turn up in the ocean like this, but it's usually just for a couple of weeks.
The idea that we would have a bloom that goes on for 5 months, I don't think anybody anticipated that.
It stretches from Santa Barbara to the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, and it's made up of tiny bits of algae that produce a very powerful neurotoxin called domoic acid. Scientists still aren't sure why they produce this toxin, but they do know that warmer than usual ocean temperatures are contributing to the problem.
That has changed a lot of things in the ecosystem. And so the environment is responding to that in ways that we wouldn't even predict.
Crabs don't eat this algae. Animals like clams and mussels do. And then the crabs eat them. The toxin actually doesn't hurt the crabs, but it's bad for whoever eats the crab. Like if birds eat crabs, they get disoriented, fly around in circles. If humans eat crabs with domoic acid, we could experience seizures, memory loss, or die. Eventually, crabs can naturally rid themselves of domoic acid, but it takes a while.
We are already starting to see the crabs have lower levels of domoic acid, particularly in places like Half Moon Bay and San Francisco. The levels are dropping.
Even if it clears up now, Clarissa Anderson says it could come back next year.
It may be that this was sort of an anomalous thing that we might not see for a while, but a lot of people, particularly in the climate sciences, are predicting that this is more of a harbinger of things to come. And if that's the case, then this kind of strange, unpredicted bloom that we saw in relation to the warm water could become more normal.
The Department of Public Health has been testing crabs all along the coast, measuring the levels of domoic acid. Fisherman Ben Platt volunteered to go out and collect some for the most recent test.
So we got crabs today from, we set three pots in each depth, in each fathom.
On his boat, he has three blue buckets. They each hold two giant Dungeness crabs. Each bucket represents a different depth. The Department of Public Health will pick up the crabs from Platt and other fishermen along the coast, bring them to a lab in Richmond, and one by one, stick them into a blender. Then they'll measure the toxicity from the blended crabs, and from those results, they'll determine whether it's okay to open commercial or recreational fishing.
There's one thing different about this industry than a lot of other ones that have problems. In most food items, people don't find out about it until somebody's already gotten sick.
There still isn't any word on when the crab season will open. Platt hopes the recreational fishery and the commercial fishery will open at the same time. He doesn't want one crab to tarnish the reputation of a $60 million industry.
It would be better for us to sacrifice, like, the holiday market for 1 year and be able to have consumer confidence for years to come than if we do the wrong thing, or if the state does the wrong thing, it could ruin it for us for years.
When the crab season opens again, Platt wants people to do what they've done for years during the holiday season: buy lots and lots of fresh local crab. In Half Moon Bay, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. This year's abnormally warm ocean temperatures are impacting more ocean life than just crab. Fishermen are seeing tropical fish like barracuda and bonito as far north as Monterey Bay. And there's been an unusually high number of shark sightings around the Bay Area. This summer, a shiver of young white sharks were found swimming close to the Monterey shoreline. And yes, a group of sharks is called a shiver. Then, a few months ago, another shiver. A Coast Guard helicopter spotted 20 sharks swimming near San Francisco's Ocean Beach. So why are we seeing so many sharks? KLW's Hannah Kingsley Ma reports.
If you want to see great white sharks in the Bay Area, the best place to go is the Farallon Islands. It's a two-hour boat ride from the Berkeley Marina, 27 miles offshore. The Farallons are part of the Red Triangle, an infamous stretch of coastline from Año Nuevo to Bodega Bay, where sharks love to hang out. Here they feast on crowds of elephant seals and California sea lions.
We're right here next to the little shark sausages. These are harbor seals along in here on the rocks.
I'm here with David McGuire. He's the director of Shark Stewards, a shark advocacy group. These boat tours are a way for shark enthusiasts to learn more about their favorite predators. but they're also a way to teach people about conservation efforts, like the recent statewide ban on shark fins. I was nervous about this trip. Like lots of people, most of my exposure to white sharks is through media like this. And I had just recently watched an unnerving video shot in Alcatraz by a tourist on her iPhone.
That's a great white!
Oh my god.
Holy crud!
You don't see a lot of the shark. Just a dorsal fin, the flick of a tail, and an expanding pool of red where a seal used to be.
Yes, oh my gosh. Dun, 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 dun.
The kid watching in the video steals the show. He's amped.
That's the awesomest thing I've ever seen in my life.
We saw that.
That's the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
And he has reason to be excited. White sharks are uncommon. Some research shows there could be fewer than 500 along our coast. And scientists are pretty sure that no one's ever recorded footage of them feeding in the bay before.
It's right under us. Oh, it's Jaws.
It doesn't mean this is the first white shark to cross the Golden Gate. There's evidence that they have. It's just that there was no one around to see them. But that's starting to change.
People are always sending me pictures of white sharks, some in San Francisco Bay near the Richmond Bridge. They're sending me pictures of white sharks right off the coast.
That's Dr. John McCosker. He's one of the world's leading white shark experts. And he loves his job.
I feel like that little kid must have felt when he saw that white shark standing on the dock at Alcatraz.
McCosker's careful to distinguish what this uptick in sightings could mean.
Does that mean that there are more white sharks off the coast? Not sure yet, but it certainly means that there are more white sharks being photographed off the coast.
In the 80s, McCosker was one of the first scientists to use electronic monitoring to study white sharks.
Later, I went back and fed a thermometer to a white shark.
How do you feed a shark a thermometer?
You reach out between the bars of the shark cage, dangling a tuna in your hand with a thermometer about the size of a flashlight in those days, and put that into its mouth.
Sounds easy, right? From that study, McCosker learned that white shark body temperatures are warmer than the waters they swim in. Since then, white shark research has gotten a lot more advanced, but no less adrenaline-filled. Taylor Chappell is a Stanford researcher who's been tagging white sharks out at the Farallones for the past decade. When I called him to set up an interview, our conversation ended abruptly.
We had about six sharks around us. So at the same time, I was trying to push the camera tag down on the fin. That's when I said, I should probably go.
When I met him in person, he was carrying an orange hot dog-sized tagging device found by a fisherman earlier that morning. It's basically a small computer that fits on the shark's fin like a clothespin. It records information about how deep they swim, when they accelerate, and where in the ocean they might be.
And it gives us an unprecedented view of what the animals are doing, so it's pretty amazing.
Some of that information is then presented to the public on Chappell's internet app. It's called SharkNet.
So you get to know the animals, and then you get to see what they're doing in real time.
You get to know sharks like Scargirl, Mr. Burns, and Tom Johnson. See their markings, find out when they last stopped by the Farallones. And there are videos too. In one of them, a shark swims through a sea of pink jellyfish. There's no Jaws music, no dramatic baritone voiceover. One of the scientists grabs the camera out of the water and wipes the lens with his fingers. It feels as close to a shark home video as I'm ever going to get. And Chappell tells me this candidness, it's important for the conservation effort.
I think that if people got to experience sharks not on television, if they got to either experience them firsthand or experience them the way that we do, then that's what I think will change the mindset from this, this fear to a real appreciation.
The shift is not just sentimental. Chappell has the science to back it up. He recently co-authored a paper that showed that while there are more documented shark attacks, the individual risk has gone down by 91% since 1950. If you're a surfer, you have a 1 in a 17 million chance of getting bitten. And Chapel's tagging research is helping to create a sort of shark census. It's a work in progress, but his team is slowly collecting data about the true number of sharks out there and how changing ocean conditions like warmer waters can influence where they go.
Were white sharks behaving differently this summer? I believe so. White sharks are certainly responsive to the El Nino event.
Shark researcher John McCosker thinks this may be because their food sources have also moved north with El Nino's warming waters. Other scientists think the sharks may be attracted to plumes of warm water that can be found close to shore. Despite the unanswered questions, scientists say studying these animals also gives us crucial insight into the well-being of our oceans.
It takes a lot of flesh to feed an apex predator of that size, and that's in fact why they are so uncommon, but also why they are so critical to the environment.
White sharks keep the ecosystem balanced and are barometers of the health of the entire food chain. That's part of the reason why scientists study them so intensely, even though the animals are rare, and why they're so happy that the public's getting involved.
I'm thrilled that there are so many opportunities now for the public at large to take photographs of natural events and send them to museums and to other agencies so that we can use that information.
On my boat trip to the Farallones, I didn't see any sharks, but I clutched my camera the entire time, waiting to snap a photo or shoot a video to add to the growing number of images we have of them. We might not know if the population of white sharks is increasing, but we know that our documentation of them is. Really, it's a democratic approach to science, one that's supplying researchers with more information on where these sharks are and giving the public the chance to see them outside the movie theater. So it's less this, and more this.
That's a great white!
Oh my god.
Holy crud!
For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley-Mott.
That's the awesomest thing I've ever seen in my life!
We saw that.
That's the best thing I've ever seen in my life!
Find out how you can track sharks in the Pacific. Go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. And now we'll turn the page, literally. It's time for the Litography Project.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh! Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
Today we've got a book report for you in which we ask Bay Area writers to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today we hear from Anne Nesbitt, a writer from Berkeley.
My name is Anne Nesbitt, and my book report is on The Wicked and the Just by J. Anderson Coates. So The Wicked and the Just is the story of two girls whose worlds and lives collide, sort of kaboom, explosively at the end of the 13th century in North Wales. One girl is Cecily, and she's English, and she comes to Wales with her father, basically as settlers in a land that's just been recently subjugated by the English. And in the corner of her home, she finds a servant girl named Guinevere, Gwynny, who seems very morose and not very jolly. But the reason is that Gwynny is Welsh, and she has just been kicked out of her house and lost everything, and now has to be a servant for the despised English. So I'm fascinated by stories about cultures that are in collision, and about places where there are very radically different points of view on what's happening. And this story is brilliant in the way that it shows those two points of view. We get some parts of it are written from the perspective of Cecily, the English girl. Then other parts are written from the point of view of Gwynny, the Welsh girl. And you really become aware of how much suffering has gone on in both of their lives, and yet how they oppress each other, I mean, especially the English girl. So I'd like to read a passage from The Wicked and the Just. It actually is the very first passage from the book, and it's from Cecily's point of view. Tonight at supper, over capon and relish, my father ruined my life. He smiled big, scrubbed his lips with the end of his cloak, and said, "We're moving house. Thank the Blessed Virgin, I sat up straighter and smoothed my kirtle. I'm weary to thimbles of Coventry. Will we be back at Edgeley Hall in time for the Maypole? No, sweeting. We're not going back to Edgeley. We're moving to Caernarvon. What in God's name is that? It's a town in Wales. I'm in my chamber now. I will never speak to him again, unless he buys me a new pelisson for the journey. I'll not go to Caer Wetsit, not while there's breath in me. I love this opening because it's completely misleading. When you hear it, you think you're in a completely different kind of story than you actually are going to find yourself in. And that's true for Cecily, too. She thinks the bad thing about the English moving to Wales is that it inconveniences girls like her who want to have nice clothes. But what happens over the course of the story is it changes from being this sort of lighthearted romp almost into something that's infinitely darker. Anybody who is interested in the really complex, difficult parts of history would be interested in this book. Here's a story that starts off as a sort of lighthearted tale of a girl being, you know, moved off to a new world. And then that new world slowly turns out to have all sorts of shadows in it. And you have this incredibly gripping description of the massacre of the English in this Welsh town and how everything flips over. And at that point, you're thinking, oh gosh, where can this go? And it manages to stay complicated, even through the resolution of the immediate story. And that is something I think is rare, and it's really gripping to read and quite wonderful.
That was author Anne Nesbitt talking about The Wicked and the Just by J. Anderson Coates. Nesbitt is the author of three novels for children. Her third, The Wrinkled Crown, just came out last month. Today's book report was produced by Mary Reese for the Litography Project. If you have a story to share, we want to hear about it. Write it down and recite it to us on our voicemail. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll share our favorites with the audience. It's because of you that we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this is the San Francisco Girls Chorus. They'll be celebrating Christmas in song during two programs this week on Wednesday and Thursday. Both concerts take place at Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco starting at 7:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.